Well, thank you for, wow, it is a lot of people up there. I was like, hey. So I've had the entire summer off, and so this is literally my first time back, like actually doing a lecture. So thank you for being a great crowd. I'm asking that in advance. So there you go. Here you go. But I am, this is the crack house that I walked to, that walked by on my way to the subway every single day for 4 years, you know, when I was in high school. Because this was in the 1970s, it was the era of the burning Bronx, financial, you know, disinvestment, had landlords torching their buildings, and it literally created this kind of like financial infrastructure in our community. There was lots, you know, where landlords were torching them to collect insurance money because no money was coming in. It was also a drug epidemic, but really it was an example of why and how brain drain happens. Like to me, you know, I was like one of the smart kids, you know, told that, you know, from the time I was like yay high to a grasshopper. And it was just like, you know, you're going to be somebody big. But I knew that if I was going to be anything, I had to measure success by how far I could get from my hometown. Now, my hometown is an inner city, but it could be a native, it could be a Native American reservation. It could be a poor white town where there was some industry, where there was lots of jobs, but it's all long gone. But we call these neighborhoods low status communities, but they're often the ones that are referred to as poor or underprivileged. And you know, but we use low status because number one, status involves that something is larger at work. And it's also an ugly word when it gets right down to, because it assumes that there's a higher status and a lower status. But really what it means is that inequality is a well-established fact, and it plays out that way. So, but these are the kind of places where the schools, public health, air and water quality are worse than in career options, food options. They're worse in those areas than in other parts of the same city or town. You know, but think of the communities like this near you. You know, they're everywhere. And they could be, again, inner cities or Native American reservations, whatever. They're all over the world. And what we know for a fact, it is the bright kids, the same ones that Ashton was talking about before. The bright kids are totally led to believe that they need to measure success by how far they get away. And they're in urban, suburban, rural. They're the places where inequality is assumed by those inside the neighborhoods and those outside of it looking in. So this talk is about our approach to community development, which focuses on a talent retention strategy. Now, we know that that's a common strategy in the business community, but we really don't apply it to community development most of the time, if we're honest with ourselves. So, but when you think about it, successful companies, they're not trying to like invest in their talent so they go to work for somebody else. But we do that in the community where we're often building, you know, affordable housing. We're not inspiring them to sort of stay and invest their talents in those same places. And, you know, when what successful companies practice talent retention because they don't want to spend their time and money doing that. But we spend billions of dollars philanthropically through government dollars, private dollars, excuse me, on the people there. And we don't see that overall outcomes are actually changing in those communities because we're not retaining the talent that we're producing. And I believe that if we can use a talent retention approach to community development, then we can, the same tool that's used to grow successful businesses, we can actually build really successful, the kind of communities that continue to pay a return to the people that are already there. And I think that's a really important thing that we want to see. So in my hometown, what we do there is we know that poverty, I love you so much. Thank you. I thought I drank enough, but clearly I did not. Oh, God. That's better. I think it will be, maybe. So even though I know that my neighborhood sort of seemed sort of like a talent, it had a talent repulsion strategy in it. Like literally, that crack house was a real thing that I saw every day for 4 years. And if we listen to kind of the way that the folks in the nonprofit sector, the nonprofit industrial complex, or the government industrial complex, and certainly the real estate development complex, it was almost as if they were building as if poverty was part of the culture. So, and the question we asked ourselves, is poverty part of the culture? And if you get it, if you listen to it, it was kind of like, yeah. But as we, because it was just like, all we saw were the kind of things that literally spoke to the things that were designed to continue, that were maintaining poverty in our neighborhood. But when, as I moved up in my own life and became a developer, and we did all sorts of market research asking folks, well, is it, you know, what are you looking for in the neighborhood of your dreams? You know, where do you go? Where do you, when you feel like you want to like do something fun in your own life, are you doing it in your neighborhood? And we literally followed the money, like what, where were people actually going and spending their money doing things? And so when we didn't ask like, is poverty a cultural attribute? Because that's like real policy wonky and nobody talks like that. But we did ask them, what do? Where do you spend your money? Like in your free time. And basically, it was the places that did not exist in their own community. They would literally go in other people's neighborhoods and spend money on things like cafes and coffee shops and bars and recreational things of that nature. And eventually, they would even go to the places where they felt like they could find the housing that actually fit their income, but also that that inspired them in the places that they wanted to be. So we watched people from our own community leave our neighborhoods and search for something just a little bit better. And these were people of all income levels. But we were also led to believe that there was nobody really in our neighborhood, which we knew was not true. Even back in the day when the Bronx was literally burning, we knew that there were people in our neighborhood that were writers and even doctors and who really inspired people around us. Did they stay often? No, many didn't. But guess what? That's still true to this day. You know, we've got people that are doctors and people who are, you know, writers and entrepreneurs. The lady with the Cozy with My Rosé t-shirt is actually a founder of a place called the Lit Bar. She combined two of her favorite pastimes, reading and wine, into the same thing as in Lit Like Literature, Lit Like Tipsy. And it's this wildly successful, you know, wine bar with a bookstore attached to it. And so those kind of things are great. And we also get visited by amazing people like Marcus Samuelson, who's a celebrity chef. The gentleman in the middle picture is Christian Navarro, who had his breakout role in a movie, in a Netflix drama called 13 Reasons Why a few years ago. And that's it. But he's from the neighborhood. His family still lives there. So we know that there's all sorts of talent, you know, in our community. But when we think about our neighborhood, if we're only being told that poverty is the way that we are defined, you know, we have to ask ourselves, like, is this true? And what are we doing in the future? Because what we've realized is that the way that our communities are developed is that there's only two kinds of real estate development there. One is we know the sort of the boogeyman of gentrification, you know, where it's all about how do you create more, you know, the area gets nicer, other folks come in and develop it, the people that are originally there get pushed out. The other kind is something we call poverty level economic maintenance. And where somebody is doing well from these type of this infrastructure, economic infrastructure, but the neighborhood itself kind of stays the same. So, you know, and you'll know these places because there's like, do you see things like, do you have different diverse options for food? No. Or do you see a ton of greasy spoon operations and what do they call them? Like chain stores or like that. Or do you find affordable and great options for dining options? Nope. Do you find economic developments? Yeah, you can find places to spend your money, but do you want to spend your money in places like this? Or do you like seek out other places elsewhere and drop your dollars there? I like a bargain as much as anybody else, but if your main option in your community is dollar stores for retail, you know you're in a low status neighborhood. Also pharmacies, as we know, it is a multi-billion dollar economic engine for the community, for this country. But we also know that it's a big part of the local real estate in low status communities, because there are a lot of folks with health conditions in those areas that actually, you know, and because we know whether it's diabetes, obesity, heart conditions, et cetera, certain kinds of cancers that come from the kind of environmental burdens that we often see in low status communities. Of course, pharmacies do well, you know, when those things happen. And of course, there's many places for people to develop self-medicated ways to get the help they want or need. And then if you want to save your money, you're probably not going to find a place, things like banks or credit unions in those areas. But you will find places that charge you a premium for using your own money. Check cashing stores, payday loan places, and rent-a-centers, pawn shops, things like that. And then also last but definitely not least, you'll see a huge amount of highly subsidized affordable housing. And in almost exclusively for the lowest income level, not, you know, attainable housing for different income levels, but usually just the lowest. And so before anybody starts to talk, because there are some people that do, will say things like, Majora Carter hates poor people and everything's associated with them. That's nothing could be further from the truth. What I do hate is the impact of the concentration of poverty and what it does to people. Because when you do all of these things that I just showed you, what you tend to do is concentrate poverty, which in turn, what you'll see is an increase in poor health outcomes, lower educational attainment, higher rates of people being involved in the justice system, bad policing, all of those things which impact mostly the people that are there. But if we're honest with ourselves, the money that goes through because of all of those type of things that happen, somebody's getting paid well. But the people and the conditions in those communities don't get better. So people also like to think, like some of my detractors will say, but if you make a neighborhood better, then, you know, you're gentrifying it and it's bad for the people that are there. And listen, I got to tell you, you know, I don't think the gentrification starts when you see things like, you know, things that you don't normally see in a low status neighborhood, whether it's the development of a cafe or a lit bar, you know, or a bookstore or whatever. It happens when we believe that there's no value in our own community. And that's when we often sell early and cheap, because there are property owners in those communities. There are often business owners in those neighborhoods, but they don't stay because we don't really, like, on a whole, believe that there's value there. But just because we don't see the value doesn't mean that somebody else doesn't. You know, as we know, you know, between these are like, you know, mom and pop, probably, you know, predatory speculators, smaller holding companies. These were actual notices that I got underneath my door from folks, you know, assuming that I don't know the value of my own home. And unfortunately, many of these folks were totally right, because we don't know the value of our own homes and we'll sell early and cheap. And of course, I'm sure a few folks in this room know that about 20% of all homes in America are now owned by private equity real estate companies. 20%, which means just literally take that, you know, off the table, any in those neighborhoods, because they're all in low status communities. They're not in, like, you know, upper level, you know, places. But we've had this opportunity, I think, you know, to recognize that we are losing the American dream for the rights of home ownership. And I think add business development into that in low status communities. And so we're at this really beautiful place where we can do something different. Because if we really stop to think about it, this could be a talent retention, you know, strategy to continue, you know, on the path that I'm about to propose. Because America has had talent retention strategies in place since before 1619. You know, we know that slavery honestly provided white Americans all the benefits, you know, of that barbaric strategy, economic benefits, you know, the same kind of benefits, honestly, that Black Wall Streets that were all over the country, you know, that actually had, they were built on the sustainable ideals of, you know, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness and property. But some suffered the consequences because they weren't born white. You know, it's the same system, but really different outcomes. So, but here's the provocation, because we don't need to reinvent the wheel here. If we want to make America as good as its promise, and I think we all do, then we need to apply the same kind of tools of capitalism that created white wealth in America to create wealth in other communities, in low status communities of all colors, you know, especially in terms of property ownership and real estate development, because real estate development in low status communities, you know, is the way that we need to go. So how do we create that kind of talent retention strategy? It needs to be beautiful. It needs to be high quality, you know, and built with a natural in environment in place, commercially viable year-round spaces so people can spend money in those areas. And they promote community, not with like the kind of, I've seen, you know, the kind of community centers that like particularly non-visionary developers will build to increase the FAR, you know, but to say like, oh, we built a community center in a place, but it's really like a not pleasant or anything like that. Quality housing for residents with good paying jobs in a range of incomes. Nobody wants poverty conflated with their culture because it isn't. Poverty is essentially something that happens to people. It's not part of our culture because we want to feel good about it. So on that note, remember the crack house that I used to walk by is part of this talent retention strategy that we've been placing out, you know, as developers. We've developed it as the Boogie Down Grind Cafe. And the book, and so it's the same exact corner, except this time, for those of you who don't know, this is the 50th anniversary of hip-hop. Hip-hop was born in the South Bronx. You're welcome. And this cafe is an homage, you know, to hip-hop, and we embrace that as part of our culture. We produce that. So it's like, I'm really excited about that. But what we've done is take this little space and literally, you know, we've sort of like pasted the walls with like early hip hop pioneers. You know, we open up the space so that you can do things like open mics and poetry readings and musical events and art events. And it really is the kind of place that makes people feel awesome about exactly where they are and thinking about their community that way. Now, we also know that because when you often heard from people, it's like, oh my God, a coffee shop is a harbinger of gentrification and it's a really terrible thing. And that's a problem. And we're like, no, actually, coffee is literally, it comes from the blackest and brownest parts of this world. And it is literally the blackest beverage on the planet. I mean, come on. But somehow or another, it's like taken over by like, you know, white guys with ironic glasses and skinny jeans. And I'm just like, y'all can have it too. However, we're going to take some of it and enjoy it because it is also part of our culture. So, but anywho, you know, but to some, and I think especially who are like, you know, sort of like emboldened by the nonprofit, you know, industrial complex in a way, and it's always a bad thing, you know, to that, it's a bad thing. And so, yeah, we were actually protested after a couple years after we built the space, you know, by some folks within the social justice industrial complex, you know, who felt like we were selling out our community by building this thing and, you know, creating this space that we didn't need because we needed other stuff. And I've not been able to find out exactly what we need from them because they don't really talk. But what I thought was really ironic was the day that we were protested was the day that we were hosting at our little cafe a meeting for folks who wanted to get low interest and 0% interest loans to keep or stay or acquire property in their neighborhood or to develop businesses. So there were 40 people inside my cafe trying to get this information, you know, from the lenders, and then also about 15 people outside, like with the pots and pans and bullhorns yelling about how awful I am. But anyway, what was also super ironic is that like our first investors in our cafe, you know, this woman was also amongst the folks there, and her family, you know, immigrants from Honduras and Jamaica, both felt like this was a way that they wanted to spend their money. So the irony of it all is just that, you know, if we're led to believe again that there's no value, even showing value and how to get it is a sort of a hard sell to folks. Doesn't mean that there aren't people who will get it, but they do. And so this is another approach for our community. This our talent retention approach. This was a former rail station. It was built in the 1910s by Cass Gilbert, who's this amazing, actually America's first starchitect. I don't know if you've heard that phrase, but he was it, Cass Gilbert. And so he was building things like the Woolworth Building and this U.S. Supreme Court Building. It's just like fabulous, and had a really funny life too. But he did these little rail stations, you know, all over the country. And this one was one, but of course it was being built around the time when cars became king and rail service started to drop. So this one around the late 1930s was turned into little mini strip malls, even though there was talk that rail station would start up again. It was a hopeful dream, but it was, you know, didn't quite happen. But we acquired this building back in the 2010s, somewhere around then, and even before we acquired it, because it was empty for a while, I hired some kids from the neighborhood to design, you know, a little mural, you know, to make it look a little nicer because it was just getting graffitied up, but not in a nice way. And so what we ended up doing And now we did the interior demolition, and we're transforming this now into an event hall. And so we're actually now listed on the National Register for Historic Places, going through the whole process, you know, to get that 40% tax credit, historic tax credit, because that is no joke, you know, to rebuild it. But in the meantime, you know, we still have this like beautiful space that we can use as an event hall. And so since then, since we did the interior demolition, and we're just waiting for the whole permitting process to go through the whole historic thing, we use it as a pop-up shop. You know, we do film and video shoots there, all sorts of fun things. We've got Malik Yoba, who is a Bronx-born actor and now real estate developer, and also he's also a filmmaker. He did a series called I Build New York, and it was about, you know, the path of real estate in New York, and the focus on Black and Brown developers. And I was in the very first episode. So of course we did the premiere at my spot, which was fun. And it was just a really amazing kind of space, you know, to be in, and still is. And so to have it there, we've even had things like pro wrestling and performances. TEDx's have popped up in there. Tarana Burke, when she dropped the paperback for her second book, did her book signing there. Pro wrestling is super fun. I mean, if you like, seriously, it is like, I had no idea how much fun like pro wrestling can be. So, and I was like, okay, we're going to have this here a lot. But long story short, we're really excited about seeing more and more, you know, things like this. And this is what it's going to look like when it's all said and done, which I'm very, really happy about. And so we're also using it as an opportunity for people to invest, you know, in that development through the crowdfunding investment campaign that we have an opportunity to work on now, you know, which means that people can invest as little as like $250 and still get a rate of return as much as like much larger investors will also be getting. So I'm really excited about that. Oh, but this is the real reason why I even have this building or why I exist at all. My dad was a Pullman porter, and his line was the New York New Haven line. And he, you know, this was in the 1930s and 1940s, and he wanted, you know, a place, you know, to get once he got a new family, and wanted to own a piece of the American dream and wanted to live like on his line, on his main line. And so he had actually won $15,000 in a horse race, actually, when he was out west, came back east because he was living in Harlem at the time, and found his line, and found that a white family in the neighborhood was all white at the time in Hunts Point, which is where, this is the Hunts Point rail station. And he literally found this family who was willing to sell him the house for cash, for $15,000 cash. And he didn't feel safe living in the neighborhood for 2 years, so he rented it back to them. But the whole, you know, but hey, you know, so what? It was still his house. And, you know, when he met my mom, that's when he's like, okay, I got a family now, you got to go. But anyway, but it was really, he's like, I'm going to claim my house. But anyway, but this is the reason why I have this house, because daddy wanted a place in the neighborhood. The rail station never reopened again, but, you know, I lived there, grew up there, and saw this place like literally every single time. You know, so it's just like, it's really kind of hilarious to me that, you know, my dad, who was the son, you know, of an enslaved person from Georgia, from America's Georgia. And now his baby girl is actually transforming this spot. So I think that's kind of cool. This was his last job, you know, which was at a former juvenile detention facility. And also this was right in the neighborhood. I saw this thing every single day walking to school. It was literally, I'd walk up the street, look down to the left, and before, you know, because you have to look both ways before you cross the street. And I saw that down the hill, and then walked to the right on the way to school. And it was a bad place. It really was. It broke children. We don't do juvenile justice very well in this country. This was one of the main reasons why this thing was closed, you know, back in the early 2010s as well. And he was a janitor there back in the day. And I remember him talking to my mom when he thought we weren't listening about how terrible it was and how he wished our house was bigger, so we could take in, you know, more kids, which we did anyway, but it wasn't as big as he'd hoped. But as an adult, I realized that that site, once it was finally closed down, thank God, to, you know, children's age advocates and things like that, you know, we realized that that site, after it was empty, could be a catalyst for the kind of mixed income housing, mixed use commercial development with home ownership and local business opportunities that could literally transform the economic, environmental, and social outcomes within our neighborhood. or neighborhoods like it in particular. So through mixed income housing and home ownership and inclusionary housing and all that good stuff, all on the same site, because it's a big site, 5 acres big, really doing the work to see like where were the jobs and business opportunities and doing that kind of market research to understand what were going to be the economic drivers, and discovered that manufacturing actually is coming back to America, in particular around tech and apparel and food. And so we really need to be focusing on that, building public space that actually create safety and the kind of, you know, the kind of beneficial multiplier effect of more social interactions that make people feel good about their neighborhood. It's a great democratizer. And of course, more commercial and retail that would provide a more of a local living economy. And also recognizing that, you know, that what was super exciting to me was that we realized that this, that the sort of like the topography of this area was very similar to a lot of low status communities in post-industrial America, you know, where there was the residential area on one side and right on the other side is where the industrial section started. And here, the white building, that's the it's residential because it was a jail. And then right next door is where, you know, the industrial area started, but it was like a little weird kind of hingy area, which is, but we knew that, so there was like a truck engine or a parking lot and thing, you know, just nothing really happened there. But what we all knew as a neighborhood was that there was this where it was sort of quiet. Truckers would go there and pick up a prostitute. And so, but what would happen if you changed the way that the ground plane worked, that so that you could have, you know, three shifts for light manufacturing, you know, if you had entrances to schools and apartment buildings, you know, and also, you know, to commercial facilities, good uses will drive out bad ones. And so we knew that this could be an opportunity to seriously change the way the ground that low status communities could be redeveloped. And not just be like a little cute one little, you know, thing that happened here, but no, we wanted to raise the bar for what passed for development. And then seeing, you know, through that, we actually put together this amazing team. We had more, you know, people of color and women owned firms involved in this huge, team that was a part of this, who was competing for the RFP to redevelop the site. And, you know, and it was so, and we actually, because I absolutely believe in diversity, we'd also had, you know, white males, you know, led teams on our thing because I value diversity. So I just wanted to say that. But it was a really kind of beautiful thing because to see what we did, because the program for the place was involving about 1,200 units of mixed income housing, including 100 units of low income home ownership that was going to be built by Habitat for Humanity in New York City. And more than 2,000 jobs, you know, were actually more than 2,000 construction jobs, and another 800 permanent jobs were going to come to this place as a result of all of the various types of jobs that were happening here. So between the home ownership opportunities, you know, there were opportunities for market rate, but also supportive housing in particular for kids aging out of foster care, and, you know, light manufacturing, as well as, you know, opportunities for commercial and educational and cultural spaces, all of which were creating that kind of like lifestyle infrastructure to make people want to be in their community. And also we had programmed in local business development to really create, you know, a path for entrepreneurs to be developed and supported, you know, before even this kind of project was actually going to be built. And unfortunately, our city decided to do the same kind of status quo thing, which was create more, which was to literally give the, you know, the first of all, the project was just given to like two regular standard developers, you know, both white male firms, you know, that was a like crazy pants. But it was also, I mean, it was typical. It wasn't crazy. It's what they always do. But then it was a completely low income, affordable housing, completely low income. This is what won the bid. And then there were no real jobs associated with any of the projects. As a matter of fact, they made up businesses that did not exist, never did, and won an RFP with it. But there was a huge health clinic and a community center associated, and that was it. Now, fortunately, they have changed a lot or a little bit of the project, but it's still, I mean, when you really think about what it could have been, they made a very deliberate decision to do the same exact thing that they always did. And it was not about creating more health and wealth and vitality for a community that had disproportionately had not had it for decades, but based on the same kind of models for development that always happened in those communities. So when we think about this, and you are knowing full well that there are folks who are thinking more and more about how do we create more change, like these kind of like notice from predatory speculators that we see, we would literally take them down whenever we saw them. And when we posted about it at one point, you know, someone in Baltimore, you know, wrote back that when we get this kind of mail offering or whatever, you know, I literally have my kids call them up and tell them to get away from my inheritance. We need to see, be able to realize that we actually do have tools, you know, that we can deploy to increase more opportunities for home ownership. And I do think that whether we, you know, help to get the financial, or rather the sort of the support, whether it's from the philanthropic community who can like buy and hold properties that we know that predatory speculators are going afterward, so that people in low status communities would have the opportunity to go and buy them from them, as opposed to giving off all the way to predatory speculators, because frankly, people need the capacity to get a mortgage. And what predatory speculators do is like, because they can buy for cash so quickly. And again, if people aren't fully appraised of understanding why they can do more with a property if they hold it, then that's something else we can do. I do also think we need things like real estate public defenders, because, you know, wouldn't it be great if once we saw a real estate transaction, you know, start to move in the direction, that there is someone who actually goes to the seller and asks them, like, are you aware that there's other opportunities you can have with your house, that you can either mortgage, refinance it, you know, actually move and start a business or things like that? Are there opportunities? Are we giving those to folks to do? And I feel like if we can create those opportunities, we can actually start moving people in a path where we can create more and more health and well-being in our communities. Because this is one of my favorite quotes from Dr. King, is from a letter from a Birmingham jail, because we can and should afford to be, we should really be thinking about inpatients, because we should be, knowing full well that the wealth gap is growing. You know, Citibank, you know, talked about how we've lost literally $16 trillion because of the racial wealth gap. Property ownership is a part of actually moving it into a different direction, but we have to start thinking about that, because if we don't, like, we know the path that we're on. We've been on it for centuries at this point, but we can actually create opportunities for health and prosperity in our community and show that we don't have to move out of our neighborhood to live in a better one if we do this properly. Thank you so much.